I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the better books in Canadian journalism is the memoir by the journalist Marjorie Nichols. Nichols was a legendary in these parts and beyond. She's remembered for her time at the Vancouver Sun in the 70s and into the early 80s when she covered provincial politics from Victoria. She'd done two stints in Ottawa, but is probably better remembered for her work at the Ottawa Citizen in the 1980s. She was a hard-working, tough reporter, a hell of a reporter, as has been ascribed to her upon her early death from cancer in 1991 at the age of 48. Mark My Words, the memoirs of a very political reporter, which was published posthumously by Douglas and McIntyre in 1992, is quite candid. There hasn't been a political memoir like it. I read it in high school several years after it came out, and it was quite a fascinating read. You get Nichols at her best, her no-nonsense style, as well as her colorful exploits and thoughts on journalism, politics, and the personalities she encountered. Nichols is most candid when it comes to her struggle with alcoholism. She bears all, and she's toughest on herself. Joining me now to talk about Nichols, her legacy, and the book is the book's co-author, Jane O'Hara. She got a call from Nichols in the summer of 1991 asking to collaborate, and she agreed before knowing that the subject of their writing would be Nichols herself. I'll ask her about the writing of this book and more. Jane O'Hara is an award-winning writer and a former national tennis champion who competed at Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. She's published two other books as well. She was national editor at Maclean's, and when she was at the Ottawa Sun, she was the first ever female sports editor in Canada. She joins me from Toronto today. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jane O'Hara. Ms. O'Hara, good morning.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for having me. Well, thanks for joining us. I appreciate you doing this, especially for to talk about a book that's been out 22 years.
Yeah, hard to believe, but it has. Hard to believe Marjorie's been dead for 22 years.
Yeah, I always thought that she was deserving of attention, just as much as, say, Webster or Alan Fotheringham. I mean, last week here in Vancouver, the Webster Awards dinner was held, and it's always interesting during the days in the run-up, people are always talking about Webster again and what he meant to journalism. But Nichols always struck me as someone who was equally deserving of attention. And for you, when she called you that day in 1991 to work together on this book, she was incredibly influential in the field, not just for women, but for reporters in general, right?
Oh, absolutely. She's had a really long career. I guess I first met her. I was covering some federal politics myself. I met her in 1979, I think it was, at a Ottawa Press Gallery dinner, and then went on sort of partying with them afterwards. I could barely keep up. But those were the days when, you know, you worked really hard, you drank really hard, everybody smoked, and it was a very, very collegial atmosphere in Ottawa, and just a lot of fun, basically.
Do you think that collegiality, do you think that's been lost in recent years?
I haven't worked in Ottawa for a while, and I know you have read the book, Joe, Marjorie had many stints in Ottawa. She kept sort of shuttling back between covering the legislature in Victoria and then back to Ottawa, even one stint in Washington. Mm-hmm. But when she finally returned to Ottawa, I think it was in 1987, Mulroney was in government, or just about to get into government, I forget the actual date, and she felt like a complete fish out of water after being this incredibly influential, irascible, anti-MAME type character in her former iterations in these jobs. When she got back to the Hill, it was TV was the big thing. She felt that print reporters were no longer respected. She felt for her own career, her experience, her hard work, her dedication, all she'd done, the millions of parliamentary committee hearings she sat through, that nobody cared about that anymore. That all they cared about was like a 30-second clip or even a 10-second clip on TV. So I think, and of course the collegiality, I mean, back in the day when she was in her heyday in Ottawa, and that would have been in the 70s, I guess, she and her good friend Hugh Windsor, who was, I think, the bureau chief of the Globe and Mail at that time, They basically rented a house together, and it became a frat house, a drop-in center, like a round-the-clock. Cabinet ministers came. Everybody dropped in on their premiers. All the, you know, the entire press gallery. It was this incredible place where there was this mix of politicians, bureaucrats, and the media, and that is definitely gone.
Yeah. I mean, I do wonder, in rereading parts of the book in recent days, what she would have thought of, the Harper regime and how Ottawa is today.
Oh, God, I think she would have. Well, there's a story in the book when I think Trudeau was holding federal-provincial meetings, and he decided to hold them, I don't know, in the back room of the railway station down there or something.
Yeah.
And she and Charlie Lynch, who was another huge figure in the world of print journalism in those days, and I think it was Ron Collister of the CBC, they actually went out and protested. I mean, they were literally out there protesting and screaming at the politicians as they walked out of these private closed-door meetings. So in terms of Stephen Harper's, she would have been, she would have just gone, we would have just put her right off the charts.
No, her reputation was that of someone who was tough, someone you didn't mess with, and that applies to, say, journalists, editors, politicians even.
Right.
Where did that come from? Was that her childhood, do you think?
Yeah, she grew up as a sort of a farm kid in Red Deer, Alberta. Her dad was an American. Her mother was Swedish. She joked about her mother that she was born so far north that she was related to reindeer. And her father, she said, was so right-wing that he thought, you know, Nixon was a communist sympathizer. So, and she did nothing but battle royals with her dad, who actually was injured in a plane crash and sort of ruled the roost of their family home from a wheelchair. And he was a tough son of a bitch, but she basically bested him as a child. And so he only had two ways of sort of dealing with her, either flattering her and bribing her, or I think actually physically beating her. I believe that is also what she said. So, and that kind of obstinate, you know, pig-headed character also came from her father, because she sounds like identical to him. And you know, at the end of her life, she was really looking for his appreciation, because I think she felt by not defeating cancer, because of course Marjorie believed she could beat anything.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody ever beat her, and she was always number one at everything. She felt that she'd somehow let her dad down because she was dying from lung cancer.
And even to the end, the relationship was fraught, wasn't it?
Right to the end, it was fraught. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like she I guess she went home to Red Deer to die,
mm-hmm.
and he was there, and I guess there was no real closure between the two of them, was there?
There was really nothing said between them, and that made Marjorie feel like she was really loved by her dad. And so, even though she fought with him, I think she was really looking for his love all those years.
There was when the book came out, because I went to the clippings files and found reviews of the book and articles about it. You'd gone to lunch with Denny Boyd at one point, and he talks about the beatings that
uh-huh.
she got. And there was one very powerful scene where, I guess, when she first stood up to him. Did you remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
She told him, fuck you, hit me again, I can take it. Do you remember that part?
No, I don't remember that. And I don't think that's in the book either, is it?
No, but he'd mentioned it in the course of this lunch that you'd had
right.
when the book came out. I mean, that must have been at an early age. So, I mean, right there, you can see how she stood up to authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that really fueled her career, didn't it?
I think it really fueled her career. She felt she was never going to be put down, bested, no matter what people did to her. She felt she could always stand up for herself. It also meant that she herself reacted often, you know, with incredible tantrums and anger and she scared the bejesus out of most people who had to deal with her.
Yeah, one of the interesting parts in the book, and we remember him in the last couple of weeks because he's left the CBC since. Greg Weston, They had a bit of a problem, I guess, over that book he wrote on John Turner.
Yeah, no, I'm going to forget the details of that exact thing, but I know what it was. Yeah,
he had written Reign of Error, which was this big book that came out, in the midst of the 88 campaign. And in the course of writing that, he'd called her and gotten some information from her and taped the conversation. He'd written parts of the conversation in the book, not attributing them to her precisely, but when the book comes out, she realizes that's her, and she goes on to denounce Weston. She writes a press release denouncing him and the book. Then he comes out and says, "Well, no, I have it on tape," and yet that didn't deter her from making his life hell, I guess.
Right, right, and that was really really very close to the end of her life, and she was, there was a time in there too where, she was on these very powerful drugs. I mean, I'm not going to try and say Marjorie wasn't like that anyway, but she could be so pigheaded. She would just keep running at things even though she was wrong, and although she always maintained that as long as something was factually wrong, at one point too, she ended up having brain tumors associated with her lung cancer, and she went on big doses of steroids, and nobody in Ottawa knew this. Nobody at her business knew this. Nobody at the Sun knew this, because they didn't want her. She didn't want them to think that there was anything wrong with her mind. I mean, that would be the worst thing anybody could ever say about Marjorie Nichols, that she had somehow lost her mental faculties because she had relied on them all her life. So I think that may have been partly to bear on that Greg Weston incident. I'm not sure, but she was also at that point too a bit of a fish out of water because, again, she was feeling that the people at her paper didn't like her. That nobody really ever commented on her column, that whole sense that she was always at the center of things, especially when she was out in Victoria or in Vancouver, where she, Fotheringham, and Webster kind of were like the three amigos of journalism, and they were, if Marjorie wrote a column, Foth would write it, write about another angle, and then Webster would come in and put it on radio or TV, and so they just amplified one another out there.
And then the three of them, Fotheringham, Webster, and Nichols, they got along really well, didn't they?
Oh, they were just the best of best of best buddies. But a lot of it was, of course, fueled by drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were, they, for example, when Marjorie moved over to Victoria to cover Wacky Bennett, the dying days of the Bennett government, he'd been in power for 20 years. And as she said, ran the province out of his hip pocket. There was no answer to the day. There was no question period. There was she called the legislature over there, it was Sleepyville.
Mm-hmm.
But when she went over there, she also found that people were on the take. She thought that a lot of the other reporters in the press gallery were, doing writing jobs for the, Ministry of Tourism or whoever, whatever. And so she could not stand this. And so she up and put the bureau, the Sun Bureau, over in the Empress Hotel, which I don't know whether you can even imagine this in today's journalism. I mean, the money that they had back then. And so they were, again, just had in that place in the Empress, they just had a running party going on all night long.
Yeah, I remember.
Not to say, Joe, they didn't work hard. Marjorie worked like a crazy person, but then, she basically partied until she dropped after that.
Yeah, that struck me in reading the book was how much money there was. I mean, I remember Vaughn Palmer, I think he told me once, that she would fly her column over to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Right, or fly a roll of film over.
Yeah.
It was, there were, newspapers were making money hand over fist in those days. They didn't have any, they were still doing well in terms of advertising, in terms of circulation, in terms of readership, all of that. So they were, it was really, really heady days. For newspapers back then, so and she was delivering for them too. She was getting scoops and making the government crazy, and so she she did her work, and so they paid the price.
So she comes to Victoria to cover WAC Bennett, and then she was there obviously through the Barrett years, and then into the Bill Bennett years, which would have taken us, I guess, to the late 70s. During the Dave Barrett years, there was an incident with Premier Bennett in the hallway.
Premier Barrett in the hallway.
Premier Barrett, that's right, yeah.
Right, right.
It was a colorful exchange.
Uh-huh.
One-sided, yeah, I guess.
I think she'd been attacking him for a number of... It was some kind of arcane little thing about the Egg Marketing Board or something. I forget what it was, but basically Barrett was under siege by everybody. He was sort of losing control of the government. They passed so many bills and so much legislation that it was all kind of getting away from him, and so his reputation was kind of suffering at that point, and I think whatever she wrote about him just sort of put him over the edge, and he ran up to her and he said, fuck you, you venomous bitch. And, of course, she wrote about it. First of all, she said to him, are you talking to me? She was the only one there. But only she would say that. Are you talking to me? And then he said yes, and then she went off and wrote her column about it, which, of course, was a bit of a, you know, picked up all over Canada, that thing, after, you know, that Barrett lost his, you know, lost it so badly with her. But she was also, in a way, kind of run out of Victoria after that, because she was like a persona non grata after that with the NDP. She got hate mail. She said she had to delist her phone number for the first time in her life, and that was something she lived on with her phone. So she said it was, you know, pretty bad. Anyway, she left shortly after that incident.
But when she goes to rehab later on, apparently he calls her, and they'd gotten along after that, right?
Yeah. There's another really, really funny incident in the book where after he was elected, he decided to go on a round-the-province tour, but unlike Wacky Bennett, who used to do this, he decided he was going to pay for it himself. So Marjorie knew he was going up to Castlegar to start the tour up there, and so she got her car and was waiting outside the airport terminal to, and then she would just follow him in whatever car he was renting.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, nobody rented a car for him, so he just hopped into her car. And anyway, it was just a funny story about how she ended up driving him, and then he wanted to drive, and she said, no, you can't drive my car, you're not insured to drive my car, and he said, well, I'm the premier, I can drive any car. So anyway, it was just one of those funny stories that Marjorie got herself into all the time.
When she calls you in 1991 and she wanted to write this book, mm-hmm. You agreed right away, is that right?
As you mentioned in your opening, Joe, I actually agreed before I knew what book she wanted me to write. I had no idea what she wanted to write, but I thought, you know, I mean, it's kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing, but I did say, yes, I'd love to write a book with you. And then, of course, it was about her, and then I knew exactly what we were dealing with.
And I guess she'd been diagnosed with cancer some years before, is that right?
She had been diagnosed, in 1991? She was diagnosed in 88.
Yeah. So I guess the impetus for writing a book was that she knew she was going to die?
Well, she never said that because we never talked about her dying because it was the last thing on her mind, and in talking to her many times, it was always how she was going to beat it. And she'd already beaten it, quite frankly. They gave her something like 6 weeks to live when she first got diagnosed, and she did last over 3 years. So... she said she really didn't want to, in some way she didn't want to write the book because she thought once she finished it, it would jinx her and she would die. But I took her to basically say, look, if I don't get this done now, I will die and this will all be lost. And I think it was actually her friend Pauline Jewett, who was a cabinet minister and a big NDP stalwart. And it was Pauline who basically said to her, you've got to write this book, and you've got to write it now. And so that's why Pauline actually gave her my name, because I had written the book on Jack Monroe, the labor leader in BC. And so Pauline liked that book and told Marjorie to phone me. So that's how that got going.
And in terms of what was in Mark My Words, did you say we're going to write about this, this, and this, or did she set the outline, say?
I have done the book on Jack Monroe, and so I had a pretty good idea how to write one of these things and what we needed to do. And first of all, it demanded a lot of time for Marjorie, which is 2 hours a day. But no, I had a pretty much, it was going to do it chronologically, start from the beginning and go to the end, wherever that end took us and whenever we ended, because she was progressively getting sick as we did this book. But we did have a few false starts at the beginning, like, so she hires me to write the book, and then she started all of a sudden showing me all this stuff that she'd written, and it was basically bits and pieces and this and that and a column here and a column there. And I went, well, okay, Marjorie, now, first of all, I'm just going to sit down with a tape recorder and we're going to go from here. And she'd push all this paper back at me. And finally, I didn't really know how are we going to proceed. And then I got her. She had an agent who was actually Suzanne DePoe, who was Norma DePoe's daughter.
Mm.
And I said to Suzanne, Norman DePoe, of course, was a legendary CBC guy.
Yeah.
And I said to Suzanne, look, you better talk to her because this is not going to work the way she wants to do it, which is try and put bits and pieces from whatever. So Suzanne talked to her and said, look, just start the process with Jane. She knows what she's doing. And so after that, after we got over that hump, and Suzanne convinced her that this was probably a more logical way to go, and time was of the essence, we just started, and I went to see her every morning, and I would tape her for about 2 hours, and then I would go back, and I would have to transcribe the tapes, and that's how we did the book. And so basically, I just put it together chronologically.
And there was nothing that she didn't want to talk about?
That's a good question.
Because reading the book, she's quite candid about a lot of things, and we can get into some of that in a bit. But I'm wondering, was there anything that she says, no, I don't want to talk about this or that?
I don't think I ever remember anything she didn't want to talk about. She was really kind of an open book, and she was very self-critical. She was very analytical. She was very descriptive of herself, even. I remember her talking to me about when she was a teenager, and she said, you know those Lummox girls who are, you know, those big hulking girls. She said, I was a Lummox girl myself. So she never pulled her punches about herself at all. I mean, there may have been ways in which she sort of deceived herself about some issues or something, but she was very just descriptive of herself.
And because of one of the more candid parts in the book is where she talks about her struggle with alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
pills,
it
seems like there's nothing held back there.
No, nothing, including the fact that when she did go into rehab, she was convinced that everybody else in the press gallery were all alcoholics, and so she was, you know, hectoring them for the rest of their lives, and, you know, she wasn't far off the truth, quite frankly.
Well, I guess when one goes into rehab, there's a zealousness that one gets. And I
uh-huh.
guess that's what she had in terms of,
right.
Preach to the unconverted, if you will.
Another thing about rehab was when she got out of it, it never occurred to her she was going to go back to drinking again. She said, I didn't even know I'd go back to drinking. I thought once you paid that money and you went in, then you had to stop drinking forever. And she did. I mean, she never did have another drink. But it was another sort of way in which she framed an argument in her mind that, you know, you pay the money and do the thing, you're quitting for good.
Now, when the book comes out in 1992, did it sell well?
Yeah, it sold very, very well. It got a lot of attention. I think Marjorie was still very, very beloved in British Columbia. It sold very well. I think we went through two editions, and then they put out a paperback edition. So I was happy with it, yes.
Now, there is a news report that I found from 1992, which talks about the book being edited just before, I guess, in that process between when it's in galleys and then when it finally goes to print. What can you tell us 22 years later about what was taken out, say?
I don't know, Joe. Can I tell you? Well, I can now because, you know, the person who really wanted it out is dead. Well, there was a story in there about Marjorie and her promiscuity, and she was also talking about that quite a bit, or a little bit anyway, and saying that, you know, that when she was drunk, she was, you know, sleeping with whoever she wanted to sleep with, but she said a lot of time it was friends, and she told me at one point she had a threesome with Fotheringham and Jack Webster, and so that went in the book. There wasn't a lot of description about it, but that went in the book, and when Webster heard about it, he hit the roof and basically threatened the publisher with a lawsuit or a libel suit. And so we just pulled it out of the book.
And I guess there was some question too, because she told you this while she was in treatment for the cancer, and there was some question that maybe she wasn't perhaps remembering things correctly.
Maybe that was, although. I'm not sure I didn't get it confirmed from one of the other people in that threesome. It's a little hazy now, but I do remember the problem when we had to take it out of the book. So
yeah. So there was no doubt on your part when you were interviewing her that some of the stories were, say, clouded by whatever drug she was on for the cancer.
You could easily say that the Greg Weston story was clouded, where she was telling her side of the story, and then, of course, I reported, because one of the other things I did in this book, Joe, is you can never really get the person, even though Marjorie had an incredibly vivid memory for most of her life. But she'd also had a very, she'd had a life where she was drinking a lot of the time. So I went and talked to, I don't know how many people, probably 50 people at least, to verify things, to fill in gaps, to whatever. And in a way, I also wove them into the book by sort of putting at the beginning of each paragraph a little introduction, which also included other voices, not Marjorie's, mm-hmm. to just sort of set the chapter up about where she was in the context of her life. So I don't recall anything really standing out where her version of events was very, very different.
In the book, and you've alluded to this already, is that these one-night stands that she'd have with other people, like mm-hmm. other friends, husbands, and the sort. She confesses in the book to some 25 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Did she go into names with you?
No, I don't think she did go into names. And I don't know whether, so there's maybe one example of where she didn't want to talk about something, but I'm not sure I pressed her for names either. So maybe maybe that was a case where she didn't really want to name names or not destroy people's reputations, but, call into question people's loyalties or their spouses or whatever. So I don't know, maybe she just didn't want to rake all that up. But she sure didn't mind doing it with Fotheringham and Webster.
Yeah. You mentioned Pauline Jewett. Pamela Wallen was a very close friend. Was right there in the hospital emptying bedpans and the sort.
Yeah, Pam had been a friend of hers since, I think Pam came to Ottawa and was working for a local CBC radio station, actually for Elizabeth Gray, who went on to do great work on Sunday morning for the CBC.
Mm-hmm.
And she met Pam and just saw Pam as another prairie gopher, she called her, right? A hard-working kid from Saskatchewan. So they became pretty good friends and stayed friends right through all the thick and thin and all the rest of it. So, yeah, so Pam started off as very much Marjorie's junior, and, she was fantastically loyal when Marjorie was sick and, really helped out and was there for her all the time.
And she was a host of Canada AM at the time, too, wasn't she?
Yes, at that point she was, yes. So it wasn't like she wasn't busy.
Yeah.
But she really took the time to spend with Marjorie. And I think it was originally Webster that ended up taking Marjorie to a doctor and getting her finally seen to at a hospital. Because Marjorie seemed incapable of actually going to a doctor at the beginning, even though she was getting sicker and sicker.
Yeah.
But Webster was flying into town one day, I guess, to see her. He was doing some kind of radio show or TV show somewhere, and he flew into town, and she asked him to come into town and take her to a doctor, which he did. And then that sort of started within 2 days, I think, she had her diagnosis of cancer.
Well, what do you think Marjorie Nichols would have thought of say, Pamela Wallen's career after journalism and going into politics, the Senate and the sort?
You know, that's really hard to say. I mean, Marjorie just thought the world of Pam. And quite frankly, even, Joe, I don't even know what Marjorie thought of the Senate. I don't think there's really any Senate bashing in my book. Maybe the Senate was held in better regard back then. But I think she would be, knowing Marjorie, I think she would be eternally loyal to Pam, no matter what kind of jackpot Pam got herself into. And so I think she would... I don't think she would have turned her back on her. I think she would have probably screamed at her for, what's happened. But I think she would have maintained her loyalty to her. And Marjorie probably would have blamed other people like Stephen Harper or something. That's what I think Marjorie would have done. She probably, you know, would have gone on a tirade about Stephen Harper.
Well, what is that about Nichols's quality to I mean, she'd get into fights with Fotheringham and Webster and others, I'm sure, and yet remained very good friends. I mean, there must have been something about her, and you got to know her near the end. I'm wondering what your experience was in terms of her as a friend.
Well, I was always waiting for Marjorie to just, you know, completely go ballistic on me, but I found that I saw none of that side of her. Now, she was pretty weak at that point, and she was just kind of desperately hanging on, and I think she knew she needed me if this book was going to get done. So I never saw that side of Marjorie, but I think it was with her, when, you know, these fights with editors and this fight, all this stuff. Like, some of them were alcohol-fueled, for sure. Some of them were when people would, you know, dare question Marjorie's integrity. And some of them, I think, at the end where, you know, people talked about, she just would go completely ballistic. Like, she'd have these huge mood swings. She'd file a column, and then she'd get on the blower to the editor and start screaming. I think it was because she was afraid, and somehow if Marjorie made a roar in the world, it would mean she was alive. And so I think at the end she was very much afraid of what was happening to her. She was alone in the world. I mean, she did have friends, but by the time she got back to Ottawa, she had a lot fewer friends. I mean, she said when she got back to Ottawa, which is where she got her lung cancer diagnosis, she said all the, you know, young people in the press gallery, nobody knew her, so they didn't respect her. People in her own office didn't really ever comment on her columns. So I think she was feeling quite lonely, and I just think it was such a bad time for her. And she kind of reverted to what she always did best to get attention and get her way, which was to just go crazy on people.
Did you enjoy the process of writing this with her?
Yes, I feel so lucky she asked me to do this book with her, because I loved the time I had with her. I would go over to her house. She lived on Brennan Avenue. She had a little bungalow there. I'd go over to her house. She'd make me coffee. I think I'd bring her the newspaper. And we just sat down and talked and talked. And she loved talking about herself. And there was nobody more interesting to listen to. And, I mean, she just had me in stitches half the time. And she wasn't even trying to. She was just talking the way she talked, which was, she has this incredible sense of humor. Which, as I said, she never really came out in her writing, to tell you the truth. She was always so serious about her writing, but boy, she was hilarious.
You know, the thing in reading the book is one realizes that there's no one like her today, is there?
There is absolutely no one like her today. I was trying to think of even a combination. It might be if Joan Rivers and Maureen Dowd ended up in the same body. but there's nobody that's got that stature. There's nobody that's got that, I don't know, can I say works that hard or was so dedicated to a life of journalism and who cared that much and who really cared that, you know, she was kind of a guarantor of democracy. And I don't know, it's just gone.
What's it like years after writing this? People are still talking about it, and not just us today, but I mean, I remember reading one time in the Toronto Star, Susan Delacourt had done a list of the best political books ever, and she did 10 on the list were, you know, Ron Graham and Brian Mulroney and Peter Newman, and uh-huh. This book was on there.
Oh, great. How is it? Well, I reread the book, of course, Joe, for this talk we're having today. And I just was so sad about the whole thing, and so sad, and yet, you know, so sad rereading about how her life ended and how sad she was at the end of her life. On the other hand, that rollicking time in the middle where she was kind of the host of Ottawa and the host of Victoria and, you know, a sought-after speaker. But I guess it kind of brought me back to the time when, really, I was there at the end of her life and saw how weak and just how it was all ending, and it was sad. And yet, as I said, there were times in the book when I just laughed out loud because, God, she was just, you know, invincible. There was like nothing that could get her down. She was hilarious. Can I tell you the one story that killed me?
Please do.
She was in the hospital at the end, right at the end, when she, you know, her lungs were constantly filling up with fluid, and her family was around her. And at some point, it was Christmas time. And at some point, a group of carolers came onto her floor and were singing. And then they got near her room and they started singing "Nearer God to Thee." And she yelled at her sister, who was in the room visiting, and said, "Dolores, bring me my handbag. I'm going to pay those people to get out of here." Who would have think that, you know, people would be singing funeral songs on an oncology ward? And anyway, it was just so Marjorie right to the end.
Your career since, you'd done, I guess, some work. You worked with Barbara Hall for a bit, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, after my book with Marjorie, I went back and I've taught some journalism, and then I went back and worked at McLean's. I ran their investigative bureau for, 3 years. We broke some great stories, one of which was rape in the military. That was the first, I think we did six cover stories on that. After that, I think that was in 2003, I think I was when I worked on the Barbara Hall campaign for mayor. So
okay, so this was after she was mayor at one point, and then she tried to run again, I guess, right?
That's right. She tried to run again.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
David Miller, and in fact, John Tory was running back then. So Tory lost then too, and Barbara lost as well.
Yeah. Was there any influence that Marjorie Nichols had on your writing, say?
Well, I shared one thing with Marjorie, I think, before I met her, but she completely, you know, pumped me up on this, and that, you know, there was nothing better than to be a great reporter. Like, I always enjoyed the reporting more than the writing. I enjoyed the research, the getting down to things. I mean, Marjorie was one of these people that would read, you know, parliamentary reports, and even if there were 8 volumes, and she was always reading the actual documents of government, which nobody does anymore. So I completely agreed with her, and actually, I really felt I was that kind of reporter myself. I was, as I said, far more interested in some way in the research than I ever was in the writing of it. Even though obviously I had to write the stories, and but to me, it was finding the information and sort of collating that information and coming up with a story that, you know, that would mean something. She was a great inspiration. She was a great inspiration to anybody that worked at the time when she was working.
Jane, I've told you earlier how long I've wanted to do this, and so I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this book. It's a wonderful book, and I think people 22 years later still ought to pick it up.
Well, Joe, thanks a million for having me, and I'd like to somehow find a way into getting this into an e-book or something, because it's even at the public libraries, it's now really only in the reference section.
Right.
I don't know what it's like in Vancouver, but there's copies of it here in Toronto, but only in the reference section. You can't even take it out.
Yeah. The book is called Mark My Words, The Memoirs of a Very Political Reporter. It was published by Douglas and McIntyre in 1992. Its co-author Jane O'Hara joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plantin.